There's a war on coal. There's a war on women. A war on ISIS. War. Ugh. What's it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add like to you, add like to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 43 of The Political Junkie. Lots of talk on Capitol Hill and on the campaign trail about war. In the Middle East, in the November midterms, it's war. The war on women, it's a Democratic Party battle cry, obviously designed to get the advantage for November 4th and beyond. Is it working? We'll see. There's the war on the Islamic State. President Obama says he already has the constitutional authority, but it would be nice to get the backing from Congress. Congress seems to be willing to give its okay, but for how long? We also step away from all the doom and gloom talk and visit Iowa, where, you heard it here first, Hillary Clinton says she's been thinking about 2016.
I'm back!
Who knew? But first, the trivia question. Rob Ford, that upstanding fellow from up north, withdrew his bid for re-election as mayor of Toronto last week, citing health issues. Almost immediately, his brother Doug declared he would run for mayor. The question, in this country, who is the last member of Congress who is succeeded by his or her brother? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Don't forget, you can get the trivia question one day early by simply checking out our Political Junkie page on Facebook every Wednesday. You can sign up for our Political Junkie newsletter, too. You can find all that and, sadly, much more at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around.
Bring only to the Undertaker!
The deteriorating situation in the Middle East led President Obama to tell the nation that the war against Islamic extremists in Syria and Iraq is on.
We will conduct a systematic campaign of airstrikes against these terrorists. Working with the Iraqi government, we will expand our efforts beyond protecting our own people and humanitarian missions so that we're hitting ISIL targets as Iraqi forces go on offense. Moreover, I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
While two-thirds of Americans support the president's decision to take action against ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State, nearly 70% have little or just some confidence the U.S. can accomplish the president's goals. But what about Congress? Does it matter if it goes along with the president's plans? The president would like it, but he doesn't necessarily think so. And what effect, if any, will all this have on the midterm elections? Janet Hook is a political reporter for the Wall Street Journal and is kind enough to join us in the studio today. Janet, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Good to be here.
Bring us up to speed on what the president's doing this week to get his plans in gear.
Well, he's mostly been talking both to members of Congress and to the public. He was looking to Congress to approve something, though, as you said, he wasn't saying that he necessarily had it. There was an amendment to a spending bill that went through the House, and it basically authorized the part of his program that might be the biggest reach and the most controversial, which is arming and training Syrian rebels.
That vote passed.
And that passed
on a bipartisan
by
vote.
A very wide bipartisan, well, not huge bipartisan, but it was a thoroughly bipartisan vote of 273 to 156.
As bad as President Obama's job approval ratings have been lately, approval of his foreign policy has been worse. I saw a recent Wall Street Journal poll had it at 32%. What seems to be behind the public's unhappiness with the Obama foreign policy?
Well, you know, the last several months, the world has been erupting in different places every month. You know, Russia invades, part of Ukraine, and there's fighting in Gaza. And I think to a certain extent, Obama is subject to the fact that these are forces way out of any American president's control. But he hasn't responded in a way that inspires great confidence in people. There's this sense of him not being totally in control. And when it came to addressing the threat from ISIS, I think he took a little bit of a political risk in taking some time to respond, because I think the American people really reacted very strongly to the videos of two American journalists being beheaded. And so I think there's a sense of him not being a very forceful leader on foreign policy. And as you said, his approval ratings on foreign policy are rock bottom and way below his approval ratings on other things, which aren't exactly sky high themselves.
He also, back in January, when he was talking about ISIL, ISIS, called it a JV operation. He seemed to belittle what is now seen to be the biggest threat to mankind.
Oh, right, right. And there's some question about whether, you know, the threat from ISIS to the United States is being exaggerated. You know, nobody really knows what this group is capable of. I do think that just in terms of public opinion and its stance on taking military action, there's nothing quite like seeing Americans lose their lives before your very eyes to get the Americans. I mean, because most of our polling on foreign policy attitudes until very recently had shown a really dovish turn among Americans. They really were kind of wanting to retreat from the world. And even still, even now, there's a plurality that wants the United States to be less active rather than more active in world affairs. And this is just something that, you know, who knows how enduring this kind of hawkish streak we now see is going to be.
When you think of the election of 2008, President Obama was elected as an anti-war candidate, unlike the Republicans, unlike Hillary Clinton. I mean, he said, enough is enough. When I'm elected, we get out. I mean, basically, he has spent much of his 6-7 years as president doing whatever he can to avoid any kind of commitment to another involvement.
Right. And I think that's why this was such a hard decision for him to come to. But the irony is, you know, one of the reasons why he's saying he doesn't need any further authority from Congress is he says that his action, his ability to take military action against ISIS is part of the authorization of the use of force that Congress passed in 2001 and 2002.
See, that's remarkable. That's,
yeah.
Can you use a congressional resolution from 13 years ago as justification for present day foreign policy?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, what he's saying is that this is a continuation of our commitment to Iraq. You know, I mean, and there are terrorism experts who say that this is just an extension of the war in Iraq. You know, it's sort of the civil strife. I don't know. It feels like a stretch. But, you know, frankly, I don't think that members of Congress are all that eager to reconsider that kind of a measure. The measure that they just passed is very short term. It only lasts until the middle of December, and it doesn't go anywhere near the authorization of U.S. ground troops. I mean, this is one of these, you know, members of Congress and war, they have a real love-hate relationship with their responsibility. They, you know, say, well, we have, you know, the War Powers Act, you know, Congress should have a voice and everything. But they really just don't like voting on this stuff.
It's funny that they always criticize the president. The president is doing all these incursions overseas. Why don't we get a say? And not too long ago, when the president said to the Congress about Syria, you know, the whole red line thing and stopping Assad, they said, okay, Congress, make a decision. And they couldn't. Basically, both sides were bailed out by the deal between Assad and Russia.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, actually, that's a really interesting point of contrast in our poll of public opinion on this matter, because back when Obama wanted to strike Syria last August, we did a poll then and we asked people, would striking a military strike against Syria right now be in the national interest? And only 21% said yes. And then when we took this poll more recently, is it in the national interest for us to strike ISIS? It went from 21 to 61%.
We're assuming because of the beheadings.
Right.
Which is pretty remarkable, given the fact what ISIS has been doing all these months, destruction and death and murder in Syria, in Iraq. And yet it wasn't until these horrific videos where suddenly it hit home.
It did. And it really hit home. One question that we asked in our poll that was really interesting is we often ask people whether they've been following a particular news event. Have you seen, read, or heard about the beheading of a U.S. journalist by ISIS? And like 94% of people had seen or heard of this. And that was actually the deepest penetration of a news event of any that we'd asked about for the last 5 years. it really sunk into the consciousness of people.
When you think of this happening right before an election, I mean, you have to go back to, I guess, 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis before, when you had the last time you had a foreign policy development happening right before a midterm election. The presidents usually don't do something like that before an election. And two, Congress is very skittish about how to vote on things like this.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact is that even now with this front and center, I think most people heading into the midterm elections are thinking more about domestic policy issues than foreign. But this does thrust foreign policy into the middle of the midterm, the closing weeks of the midterm campaign, in a way that nobody would have guessed a couple months ago. There was actually a study that the Kantar Media Group did of all of the ads in the major Senate races through the end of July. And they looked at ads of both sides of like 8 Senate races, and there was hardly any mention of foreign policy. And there have been a lot more, you know, it's still overwhelmingly not focused on foreign policy, but it has crept into some of the campaign rhetoric, mostly from the Republicans, using this as yet another example of how feckless Obama's leadership is.
Although we've heard people like Hillary Clinton talk about President Obama should have a more aggressive foreign policy, a more assertive foreign policy. We saw how her vote in 2002 on Iraq affected her in her bid for the presidency in 2008. What is the Democratic left going through right now? The last thing they want is another foreign incursion. What is the left wing saying? If Mitt Romney were president, would the Democratic left be this quiet?
Right. And, you know, they're not exactly quiet. I mean, if you look at the vote in the House, the opposition came from basically the right wing of the Republican Party and the left wing of the Democratic Party. And I guess what I wonder about in terms of the political impact on the midterms is if this basically undercuts the enthusiasm for the midterms and supporting Democrats, if the left feels like they're, you know, kind of going down another hawkish path. I don't know. It's hard to see. I mean, there really was quite a flurry this week after General Dempsey said it testified that maybe if the airstrikes alone don't do, that he would consider other options, maybe including ground troops. And that made a lot of Democrats very, very skittish. And so then President Obama then in Florida insisted that no, he has no plans to commit ground troops. I mean, people are going along with this because it's airstrikes and not because there are no boots on the ground involved.
What do polls show? We talked about what Democrats and Republicans are saying on the Hill. What does the Wall Street Journal poll say about the American people?
Well, actually, I was very surprised. We asked people if they thought military action against ISIS was justified, what kind of military action? And fully one-third said that they would be willing to go along with ground troops. The plurality was 40% said military action but limited to airstrikes. And then something like 35% said airstrikes and ground troops. And then a much smaller number said no action at all. So that was pretty hawkish.
Do we think this kind of policy could play a role in the presidential race in 2016, both on the Democratic and Republican side?
Oh, you bet. I mean, one thing that Obama has made perfectly clear is that whatever it is that he's doing, he's not expecting it to be a short program. So it'll probably continue through the rest of his presidency. He's even warned his successor, basically, that it's going to continue into beyond his second term. And you've pointed to some of the really important dynamics within both parties, that Hillary Clinton is seen as kind of hawkish. She's been more, as Secretary of State, she took more hawkish positions internally than President Obama sometimes came out with. The left isn't entirely happy with that, and they'll have to kind of figure out whether they pressure her to rein it in or just swallow it and support her. And an even bigger debate on the Republican side, if in fact Rand Paul does stick with his more anti-interventionist point of view. Senator Marco Rubio has tried to stake out a position for himself as a vocal proponent of more hawkish foreign policy in contrast to Rand Paul. And he flexed some of those muscles in the Senate Foreign Relations hearing with Secretary Kerry.
If you think back to 2008, Barack Obama was elected president, perhaps mostly on his opposition to the war in Iraq. And this seems to be ironic, at the least. The fact is, in the latter part of his presidency, once again, we have Iraq hanging over his presidency.
Yeah, we tend to think of presidents as, you know, agenda setters, that they come in and they want to do things and they decide what the issues are that Congress and the nation are going to address. And he started his presidency kind of like that, which was that he had the economic recovery plan, he had his health care plan, and he had his plan for withdrawing from Iraq. But, you know, presidents also have to deal with forces beyond their control, and the world has turned into one fat, big, fat force beyond Obama's control.
Janet Hook is a political reporter with The Wall Street Journal. She can be found on Twitter at HookJan. Janet, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
You're listening to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. One reason the Republicans were thought to have a leg up in this year's battle for the Senate is this fact. Nearly all of the key races are in states that President Obama lost in 2012. You know, states like West Virginia or Montana or Arkansas. What's complicated the Democrats' task is the terrain has spread to some states that Obama won, like Colorado. There, Senator Mark Udall is running for a second term, but facing a tough challenge from Congressman Cory Gardner. The race is tight. Maybe Udall is up by a couple of points in the polls. And one issue that seems to have taken over is about women's reproductive rights. Floyd Cerulli is an independent pollster and political analyst out of Denver, head of Cerulli Associates. Floyd, great to have you back on The Political Junkie.
Good to be with you, Ken.
Well, Gardner was once advocating the outlaw of abortion. Till he got in the Senate race, he supported the state's personhood amendment. Explain what that is.
In Colorado, we have a fairly easy ballot access, and pro-life forces have for several years tried to pass an amendment to the Constitution, which is called personhood, and that is that a child at conception would have full legal rights. The general feeling is, arguably, this would provide some rights for the child in, say, legal proceedings related to crimes. But a lot of people felt that it really was a Trojan horse to ban abortion, to find a way to get into the Supreme Court on the issue. So it did not have, it's lost in at least two occasions, only gotten about 15 or 20% of the vote. And it doesn't really have the support of many normal pro-life forces like lots of religious organizations, including the Catholic Church.
Well, Cory Gardner supported it at least in the two times it was on the ballot, but then when he got into the Senate race, he disavowed his support for the amendment. How are voters responding to the change in position?
Well, frankly, if he was not dealing with a multi-million dollar campaign that pointed out that, number one, he had supported it, that he still supports or has recently supported a right, similar right in statute in Washington, D.C., and some other sort of pro-life initiatives that he's been involved with, he would probably be okay with it because it obviously was somewhat painful. He angered some of his pro-life supporters, and he sort of demonstrated a sense of reasonableness. He combined that with what many Republicans are doing and talking about providing 24-hour over-the-counter contraception and some other things. But unfortunately, Udall and his the political PACs associated with him have been spending millions to remind the voters that's what Cory Gardner did. And hence, there is a huge gender gap benefiting Senator Udall, maybe 15 to 20% in some polls.
And here's one of the Udall campaign ads.
Because this really matters, it's important you hear this directly from me. My opponent, Congressman Gardner, led a crusade that would make birth control illegal and sponsored a bill to make abortion a felony, even in cases of rape and incest. His record is beyond troubling. It's wrong. We're talking about your rights as women, as families, as Coloradans. I'm Mark Udall. You have the right to live life on your own terms, to make your own choices. And that's why I approve this message.
How's that argument playing?
I think quite well for Udall. As I say, there is a substantial gender gap to his benefit. He has been up in most polls by 3 to 4%. And consequently, the forecasters, the people that are using models nationally, while it's still considered a close race, have been sort of moving him down, less and less vulnerable. Of course, now it's getting close. There's a possible wave out of Washington, so things are sort of tightening up again, possibly. But in any event, that I think, worked. The bottom line is attempting to call Cory Gardner extreme, too extreme for Colorado, emphasize that you should have your own rights, you should be free to make your own decisions. Those are great themes, and you could tell the voicing and the background music. It was I thought very good, and I believe it's been working. It's probably exhausted at this point, but it has been working.
I would say that Gardner must think it's working.
What's the difference between me and Mark Udall on contraception? I believe the pill ought to be available over the counter, round the clock, without a prescription. Cheaper and easier for you. Mark Udall's plan is different. He wants to keep government bureaucrats between you and your health care plan. That means more politics and more profits for drug companies. My plan means more rights, more freedom, and more control for you. And that's a big difference. I'm Cory Gardner, and I approve this message.
It's the battle for female votes, isn't it?
It is. It's targeted to maybe 50,000 women in the state in a variety of categories, some in the suburbs, better educated people under some cross pressure. They might like Gardner's conservatism on financial issues, on the size of government. But on the other hand, they're pro-choice. They're also looking for younger women who might not be motivated to vote. But that's it. They think this race could be 20,000-30,000 votes. That'd be a couple of percentage points, and they think they're primarily going to be women.
Earlier in the show, we asked Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal whether foreign policy would be playing a role in any of these tight Senate races. One, is foreign policy playing a role in Colorado? And two, I saw that you'd all gotten some hot water last week about that. What happened there?
Well, in the I think just sort of casually, I don't think it was anything was meant deliberately. He used the beheadings of the two Americans in a speech, and it was done in a way that I think led him to be criticized that he was sort of taking advantage of them and using them for his own political purposes. He immediately apologized. But on that question of foreign policy, and I think it's sort of interesting, it's certainly secondarily involved, and that is it appears to be contributing to, one, the continued very low rating of the president, which is extremely important here, his low approval rating. It seems to be slipping very closely to now 40%. And as you know, his foreign policy approval rating is maybe at 32%. It's much lower. So it's contributing that way, because anything that the president is clearly a drag on Democrats here, including Mark Udall. And the second is probably the timing of it. It is now sort of dominating the headlines, and for the most part, you know, there's just a lot of controversy around the plan, and so it is providing some additional background noise that Washington is not working very well, and in particular, the president is not really on top of this. So, are there any ads up on it? No, and I haven't really. I've heard a little bit of it mentioned in a debate, but it is still very peripheral in terms of the direct campaigning. But it's I think negative background noise for Democrats.
What are the candidates doing in the final couple of weeks of the campaign? What's their focus?
Well, there's an interesting sort of a debate going on. Our other senator here, Senator Bennett, is actually in charge of all the Senate races for Democrats, and he is an expert. He survived one of these very difficult races in 2010 here in Colorado, and he has really dedicated himself to get out the vote. And so it's being pointed out here that instead of just putting millions and millions into advertising, and we are awash with it, you can barely buy another ad. Nonetheless, a significant amount of money is being put into grassroots, walking, phoning, emails, but in particular, just direct voter contact. We're having a brand new election here with all mail back voting, brand new for Colorado.
So women can't vote?
Yes, exactly. Mail back. That's okay. Right. And it starts on October 15th. And you will then be able to chase the ballots. That is to say, if you can identify, and I think most of these campaigns have, who your base supporters are, people by calling them or by just assuming it by registration, you can bother them until they turn in that ballot. And for Democrats, that's incredibly important because they assume there's several hundred thousand Democrats, younger Democrats, minority Democrats, some of these women we were talking about, who might not otherwise vote. And so that's going to be just sort of around the clock. God help you if you don't turn in your ballot early, because you will be encouraged to the last moment. And so that'll be interesting to watch. Can that alone help pull Democrats through in a year in which, as you point out, there's problems in Washington, but there's also basic turnout problems?
Floyd Cirilli is a Colorado independent pollster and analyst based in Denver. He can be found on Twitter at FCirilli. F-C-I-R-U-L-I. Floyd, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you. It was fun.
The fight for female voters in Colorado is being replayed around the country. Democrats argue that by their votes and rhetoric, Republicans are waging a war on women. Republicans say this is just a ploy by Democrats to energize their base. But the gender gap is real, in both directions. A recent Wall Street Journal NBC News poll shows Republicans holding a 17-point lead over Democrats among men for this year's midterms, while the Democrats' advantage over Republicans among women is 14 points. Susan Carroll is a professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Susan, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you've heard this a million times, and I just want to ask you, what does the term war on women mean to you?
Well, it is a term that came about during the last presidential election as a way to describe what the Democrats perceive the Republicans to be doing in terms of policies toward women. So it's clearly a political strategy, but one that comes out of policy positions that were being expressed by some of the Republican candidates at the time, mostly regarding contraception, reproductive rights, and to a lesser extent, pay equity.
The actual battle for female voters seems to be a major theme in this year's midterms, and it's being waged by candidates from both parties.
Yes, very much so. Women outvote men, and they have since, statistically, in terms of proportions, since 1980. And with each successive election, it gets to be a larger difference between women and men. So if you just take the last off-year election, not the presidential election, but 2010 election, there were 5 million more women than men who voted in that election. So candidates know they ignore women voters at their own peril. So, yes, you see candidates on both sides of the aisles trying to win over the votes of women. In this election, I think it's particularly important for the Democrats because the Democrats really need to mobilize women voters if they have any chance at, holding on to the Senate and minimizing the Republican strength in the House. Because what happens between a presidential election and an off-year election is that women drop off in larger numbers than men. You know, women tend to still outvote men in off-year elections, but by a smaller margin than in presidential elections. It's critical for the Democrats, if they want to do well in these elections, to mobilize as many women voters as possible.
Well, that explains why we saw in the previous report about Colorado how crucial the women vote is in that Senate race.
It's very important for the Democrats to try to mobilize the women voters. Republicans want to try to turn out the women who support them as well. In fact, Republicans get strong support from women who are small business owners, women who are higher income voters. And, of course, it's the higher income voters who tend to turn out at a higher rate in the off-year elections when we don't have a presidential contest.
And Democrats are pushing bills in Congress like the Paycheck Fairness Act. They know it's probably not going to go anywhere, even though they do support it. But it's designed to do what? What is it designed to do politically?
Well, they're pushing it because it's their strategic advantage, right. but they also, I think, sincerely, many of them sincerely support it. I mean, the reason it's not going to go anywhere and not be passed into law is because the House is controlled by the Republicans, and the Republicans, you know, haven't shown any propensity to try to pass it. And Republicans will say, in fairness to Republicans, that they, too, support pay equity. They just have a different approach.
We've heard a lot about Republican missteps and gaffes in this cycle and previous cycles. I mean, Todd Akin on legitimate rape is the perfect example. But do you get a sense, have Republicans learned any lessons from this? I mean, every time they mention the word rape, something goes wrong and something backfires. And do you think they learned any lessons?
You know, I think the Republicans have learned lessons. They certainly have been trying to school their candidates to avoid talking about issues where they might have those kinds of mishaps, where they might say the wrong thing. There's been an emphasis on how to deliver the Republican message more effectively to reach women voters. So I think there has been. You know, the Republicans have learned from what happened in the 2012 election, but that doesn't mean they can control every candidate.
Also, you know, I noticed that Republicans have been obviously trying to recruit female candidates. They have in some of the high-profile races, like for the Senate in Iowa and Michigan and West Virginia. Does that make a difference at all, or is it much deeper than that?
Well. They have been making an effort, although it doesn't look like in terms of the, you know, we track the candidate figures at the Center for American Women in Politics, and it doesn't look like the numbers of women running for Congress in either party are way up this year. So neither party's done an exemplary job. I mean, there's still a lot of room for improvement. There's no doubt that having more women running for office can help the Republican Party with its image problem with women. It can send a message, a symbolic message that it cares about women, that it's more open and inclusive in terms of women, and that's important. But the gender gap itself seems very much to be rooted in policy differences between the two parties. And certainly one of the most long-standing and important fundamental differences is that if you ask women and men, and this has been the case over many years, if you ask them about the role of the federal government in people's lives, what you find is that men are much more in favor than women of strong cutbacks in terms of federal government. Women are more concerned with, than men, with preserving the social safety net, that cutbacks in government could go too far. So they really do, men and women really do, in the aggregate, see the role of government in different kinds of ways. And that manifests itself on a variety of issues. But there is this difference in terms of how they see the government and the role that government can play in our lives.
Well, you mentioned that more women than men do turn out, but it's simplistic, I think. I mean, I'm asking you if you agree that to say that, well, this is a Democratic voting bloc, because if you look at numbers among white women or married women, they vote sizably, you know, for Republicans.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, a majority of white women do tend to vote for Republican candidates, and that's true for married women as well. On the other hand, Democrats do tremendously well, have a great advantage among women of color. They have a great advantage among unmarried women. You know, so Democrats try to maximize the turnout among their subgroups, Republicans among their subgroups. But certainly women are not homogeneous any more than men are homogeneous. Right. It's just that when you aggregate across all the different subgroups, what you find is that statistically, you know, women tend to prefer Democrats to a greater degree than men, and men tend to prefer Republicans to a greater degree than women.
We always say that this year or that year or whatever is going to be the year of the woman. We've been saying that a long time. Looking at 2014, what's your perspective of how 2014 is a year of the woman or not?
This is not the year of the woman. If we're lucky, we will see maybe an increase of maybe one in terms of the number of women governors Women may pick up a couple seats in the Senate, one or two seats in the Senate, you know, a small number of seats in the U.S. House. You know, there are people who've either lost their primaries in the House, women who've lost their primaries or who are running for other offices. So there's some that need to be replaced. But the gains this year are likely to be incremental. The numbers will probably go up a little bit, but we, you know, we still are under 20% when it comes to the proportion of women in Congress. You know, we still have a long way to go, and this year's election is going to make a tiny step forward.
Susan Carroll is a senior scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. Susan, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what's the first state to have a woman as its governor, as well as one of its senators at the same time? And the answer is Kansas. In 1990, while Republican Nancy Kassebaum was winning a third term in the Senate, Joan Finney, a Democrat, was elected governor. And the winner is Christine Yaw of Shaker Heights, Ohio. Christine gets the coveted political junkie button. Last week, we also had a special listener-submitted trivia question. Let's take a listen.
Hey, Ken. This is Michael Brooks in Alabaster, Alabama. We're a suburb of Birmingham. I have a trivia for you. Do you know the only U.S. president and spouse who attended the same high school? I enjoy the podcast, listen to it every week, and appreciate your insights and your good humor.
Well, thank you, Michael. And we told you listeners that the first to call in our Google voicemail inbox with the correct answer would get to be on the show. Lo and behold, just hours after the podcast went up, we got a call from Jim Foster with the correct answer, Harry and Bess Truman. Jim's on the phone with us from Enola, Pennsylvania. Jim, welcome to the Political Junkie. And how the heck did you know that answer?
Well, I found it the way that everybody who is not Ken Rudin probably finds it. I Googled it, and it was about the fourth or fifth item that came up.
Well, congratulations, and I know that you obviously have an interest in political history, as we do, so why don't you just tell us your like most vivid political memory?
Well, one of my first political memories is when I was a very small boy in 1960. I remember staying up as late as my parents would let me to see who was going to win the presidential election between Kennedy and Nixon. And finally, my mom laid down the law and made me go to bed. So I stayed in bed as long as I could and got up the next morning. And then I heard Chet Huntley announce that John F. Kennedy was going to be the next president. That's probably my most vivid and one of my earliest political memories.
Wait, Kennedy won that one? Kennedy won that one?
See, that's what I hear, yes.
I'd have to Google that.
Did I get that wrong? Or?
No, I'm teasing, of course. I just forget. You know, it's so long ago, I don't remember these things anymore. But, you know, what I love about politics, and I think it's like a baseball, too, that we can talk about things that happened today. We can talk about things that happened years ago. And I like the fact that you're so quick on the draw with your answer to Harry and Bess Truman.
Yeah, well, Harry and Bess Truman, I have to say, predated me, although Harry Truman was still alive when I was a small boy. But Harry was a great fellow because you're probably doing like everybody else is and watching the Ken Burns show on the Roosevelts. And the Roosevelts, it almost seemed like they were anointed to be president from the womb. And Harry, from what I've read about him, he wasn't like that at all. You know, he had a nondescript career and was, kind of an associate of the Pendergast. And then lo and behold, he got picked to be vice president and boom, he was president of the United States. It was, you know, he was just an everyday person, kind of like me, who happened to become president. And, I had a special kind of affection for Harry Truman.
Not too many presidents have come out of Pennsylvania. I know a bunch have tried. You had Rick Santorum, you had Bill Scranton. I think you had Milton Schaff for a while. But not many presidents coming out of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the only one who came out of Pennsylvania, I believe, was James Buchanan, and he may have been our worst president ever.
Jim Foster, the winner of this week's special trivia challenge. He joined us by phone from Enola, Pennsylvania. He gets the coveted political junkie button. Jim, job well done, and thanks for listening to the show.
Thank you.
Well, some other political junkies guessed Jimmy Carter and his wife, Hurricane. No, wait. That's Rosalind Carter. I'm sorry. Rosalind Carter, his wife. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter did go to the same high school in Plains, but they didn't meet until Carter was in naval school. So more than one president and spouse attended the same high school. Do you have a question, comment, or a piece of trivia you want to zing me with? Call our Google voicemail inbox at 316-KEN, that's me, 9646. That's 316-536-9646. 316-536-9646. Give us a call and we'll get you on the show, hopefully with a better voice than mine. You can check out each week's trivia question and scuttlebutt puzzle at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And follow the podcast on Twitter for all the stories we're following and my on-air appearances. That's at Ken Rudin Junkie. It's time for This Week in Political History. He was a powerful three-term senator, chairman of a major committee, battling the president's nominees at every opportunity and hoping that it would lead to a successful bid for the White House. But when accusations of plagiarism became too great to withstand, Senator Joe Biden of Delaware bowed to reality and announced his campaign was ending. Here he is on September 23rd, 1987.
In my zeal to rekindle that idealism, I made some mistakes. But now, the exaggerated shadow of those mistakes has begun to obscure the essence of my candidacy and the essence of Joe Biden.
It was 27 years ago this week that Joe Biden withdrew his bid for the White House. But before he left the podium that day, he hinted that he was not through with presidential politics forever.
There'll be other presidential campaigns, and I'll be there, Oliphant. I'll be there. There will be other opportunities. There'll be other battles in other places, other times. And I'll be there.
Larry Raske was Biden's campaign press secretary back in 1987, and he was with him again in 2008 when he ran a second time. And will he be with him if he decides to make a third bid in 2016? We'll find out. Larry, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. It's a thrill to be here.
Remind us where Joe Biden was in the fall of 1987. That's when he was spearheading the effort to stop President Reagan's nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court.
Yes, in fact. It was actually, there was some trepidation leading up to his announcement in the campaign. There was always a fear that Reagan might drop a nominee, that Powell was going to resign, which he ultimately did.
Lewis Powell.
And then, that Reagan would have a nomination and it could throw the presidential race into a tizzy. And that's exactly what happened. And obviously, when Reagan nominated Bork, which everybody feared, he was the most ideological candidate that Reagan could possibly have nominated. And then Roe versus Wade and every other major Supreme Court decision hung in the balance and hung over the presidential campaign.
But you had Joe Biden as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, basically the guy who was going to stop this nomination.
Well, that
and run for president at the same time.
That was both the fear and the expectation. And Joe had a very different view of how to stop the Bork nomination than the liberals, Kennedy and Metzenbaum, had on the committee. He didn't believe that it should be an abortion fight. He wanted it fought out on constitutional grounds, on legal grounds, and ultimately decided on fighting Bork on the right to privacy. But it was because Biden was such a threat and the Bork nomination was propelling him forward at a time when it really mattered in the presidential campaign that he became a threat both to the Democratic candidates he was running against and the Reagan White House.
Stepping away from the Bork fight for a second, as a candidate, he was raising a lot of money. He was moving up in the polls in Iowa. He was, a lot of people were paying attention. So before this plagiarism stuff, what was the focus of Biden's campaign? What was he running on to be the nominee in 1988?
Well, in essence, Joe Biden was the Barack Obama of that campaign.
He was clean and articulate?
He was clean and articulate, quite articulate. In fact, Joe Biden could make chills come up and down your spine, as he did to me the first time I went to see him speak and signed up to support his candidacy and was lucky enough to be offered the job to be his communications director. But Joe had it all. He was handsome, articulate, dynamic, and he had a sense of idealism that Americans were yearning for. And at the time we entered the race, it was such a dynamic time. Gary Hart had started the race at the front as the front runner and was already out of the race by the middle of 1987 because of the Donna Rice scandal. And Joe began that race with more money in the bank than any other candidate. And we were coming in Iowa like a house on fire when the Bork nomination came in. It was an exciting time. We thought we were going all the way.
You mentioned Gary Hart, and character became a big issue in 1987 for the Democrats. And so when plagiarism charges were raised against Biden, that was also a character question.
Yeah, well, it was really the way I think back on it, you know, kind of the beginning of gotcha journalism. It was kind of, could you, you know, find that character flaw? And there was skepticism about Senator Biden in the press corps. The Washington press corps in particular didn't know Joe Biden, and that was one of the real challenges that we faced during that entire campaign, because even though he had been in Washington as a senator for a long time, he was not of Washington. Remember, he commuted on the train every day from Washington to Delaware and back again, which is a ritual that had begun when his first wife had been tragically killed, and he started going back and forth to be with his sons, but never embraced the culture of Washington, which, you know, made him kind of an outsider a little bit in that race. You know, and so they were looking for that character flaw in Biden, you know, and, you know, to some extent we gave them the ammunition. But there's really a lot of false mythology around the plagiarism charge and having lived through it. You know, I know that it still is a little bit galling to the vice president because I was there and I know what really happened.
Well, you mentioned gotcha journalism.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, wasn't it a fellow Democrat who brought up the Neil Kinnock tape? It was a fellow Democrat who talked to the press about the similarities. But in fairness to my initial question here,
yeah,
Joe Biden admitted that he plagiarized the law school article at Syracuse. No? You're smiling.
Well, again,
tell me.
Exaggerations, you know, perpetuate themselves over the years. He did not footnote, you know, on a couple of occasions in a law paper, and he paid the price having, you know, like any college student, you know, he got an F in that course and he had to retake it again. But to say that he plagiarized is, again, part of the mythology. And, you know, Joe's a big boy, so he stepped up. He made a clean break from it. But in fact, and I think that this is worth telling people, you know, when Joe Biden first heard and saw the Neil Kinnock tape, he was compelled by the idea that Kinnock's party, which he talked about in Britain, had given him a platform on which to stand. And Biden felt that inside of him, and he used it extensively in Iowa. And he quoted Kinnock dozens of times, and it was reported that he quoted Kinnock dozens of times. And do I have time to tell this story?
Sure.
Okay, so Bork gets nominated. We pull down the campaign schedule. We retreat to Delaware, basically so that Senator Biden can do his homework to prepare for the Judiciary Committee's hearings. Meanwhile, the Iowa campaign staff is clamoring for Biden to come out because we have this momentum going on. We go out to do one debate. Biden gets off the plane. Our campaign manager is there to meet us, who was David Wilhelm, who ended up running Bill Clinton's campaign 4 years later. And Joe says, you know, I hate the closing remarks to the debate. And David, in all his innocence, says, why don't you use the platform stuff? That's been working great out here. And Biden says, great idea. And then the rush of a debate forgets to attribute the quotation to Kinnock. I was there. Joe knew when he walked off the stage and said, should we go back and correct that? And we said, no, I don't think so. There's 100 reporters here who have heard you use it before. And then a week later, it's on the front page in the New York Times, and we're facing a death sentence.
Well, I was going to say, this is the kind of stuff you would hear on the news. Here's a report from NBC News.
And I started thinking as I was coming over here, why is it that Joe Biden is the first in his family ever to go to a university? Why is it that my wife, who's sitting out there in the audience, is the first in her family to ever go to college?
Why am I the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations to be able to get to university? Why is Gladys the first woman in her family in 1,000 generations? Was it because they were weak? Those people who could work 8 hours underground and then come up and play football? Weak?
My ancestors who worked in the coal mines in northeast Pennsylvania and who come up after 12 hours and play football for 4 hours?
I'm sitting here with Larry Raske, who's reliving or hearing those words 27 years later.
It's my life.
You would see that on TV night after night after night. What did you go through? What did Joe Biden go through?
Well, he was appalled, obviously, because character is everything to Joe Biden.
Especially at the time with Gary Hart.
But he is a man who lives by his word. And he often says, I give you my word as a Biden. He believes it inside of him that, you know, your word is your honor. So to have your words thrown back at you like that. But again, the Dukakis campaign was artful in the way that they handled that tape. And we were, frankly, caught flat-footed by it. And we didn't respond quickly enough and forcefully enough.
As I said earlier in the interview, you were having momentum in Iowa. When did you realize that the campaign was not going to survive this?
Well, it's never the first story that gets you, Ken. So there were a series of stories that all came over a 1 to 2 week period. First, it was the Kinnock story. Then there was a story about a speech in California where there was a quote from Bobby Kennedy that was written in by his staffer that was also not attributed. There were three or four stories. And finally, the pressure of that. And what we realized, we sat around at Joe's house, and he did not want to get out. But we knew we had three issues hanging in the balance. We had the presidential campaign, we had the Bork nomination, and we literally had Joe's larger political future hanging in the balance, and we made the decision, and he ultimately made the decision, that we couldn't do all three, and that was more important to try and stop Bork and keep him off the Supreme Court, and he made the decision to get out. And actually, when, you know, that original clip that you played, and when he withdrew, we had conducted the Bork hearings in the morning. He had conducted the Bork hearings in the morning, came out at lunchtime into a Senate caucus room, made his withdrawal statement, and walked back in to conduct the Bork hearings in the afternoon. And a month later, we defeated Bork, and he was kept off the Supreme Court.
And you were with him again when he ran 2 decades later. Oh. And then he faced a different kind of roadblock. It wasn't plagiarism. It was running against political giants in Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. How did he hope to compete against those two political giants?
You know, I think that Joe believed and that he was the best person to be president at that time. He had talked about getting into the race 4 years earlier. And after Kerry lost, I think both the vice president and Jill Biden were distraught that we were going to have another 4 more years of Bush. But it was a very methodical process, you know, in which he really checked everything inside of him in terms of what his beliefs were, and that he believed that he was the right person to be president. And I don't think there was any of us around him who didn't agree. And so it wasn't, you know, I mean, again, Barack Obama was not a political giant when he entered the race. He was after the first finance reports were filed. But, you know, Joe was not intimidated by Hillary, by any other, you know, political figure. He's perfectly capable of being on the stage with anybody, as the debates proved, which is why, you know, President Obama ended up selecting him to be his running mate.
Well, he is a sitting vice president, and I read somewhere that the presidency will be open in 2016. Do you have a gut sense? Do you talk to him about that?
I kept it strong from time to time about the topic. You might imagine people ask about it. But I really don't know what he's going to do, and I don't think he's made up his mind.
When he travels to Iowa, like he was in Iowa pretty recently and he'll be going there again, right? What is he hoping to do?
Well, he's campaigning for the ticket. I mean, right now.
2014.
I think, yeah, Bruce Braley is in a tough Senate race. We also have a guy running for Congress, Jim Maurer, an Iraq war veteran who's very close to, you know, the vice president. And he's running against Stephen King for his congressional seat. So, I mean, the vice president is going to campaign hard for Democrats. And, you know, if we happen to end up in Iowa and New Hampshire, there's a couple of tight races there. You know, it can't hurt.
If he decides that it's hopeless for him in 2016, if he's never going to become president, when all is said and done, how do you think he'll sit back and assess his career?
I think he will be very pleased, especially, you know, with the last 8 years. I think he feels like he supported the president well. He's represented the country, and his voice has been heard, and he's made an impact. And both in the Senate, you know, going back to the Bork hearings and all the other, you know, the Violence Against Women Act, which he wrote and sponsored, which is so obviously this week really brings home the importance of some of the things that Joe Biden has done over the course of his career.
Larry Raske is the CEO and chairman of Raske Bearline Strategic Communications. He's the former Biden for President press secretary in both 1987 and 2008. And he's on Twitter at Larry Raske. Larry, it was great having you on the show.
Ken, it was great to be with you. Thank you so much.
It was 27 years ago this week that Joe Biden ended his first bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. This is going to come as a shock to many Americans, but Hillary Clinton is thinking about running for president again. She said so last Sunday during a trip to Iowa.
Well, it is true. I am thinking about it. But for today, that is not why I'm here. I'm here for the steak.
Her visit to Iowa was her first since January 3rd, 2008, the day she finished third in the state's Democratic presidential caucuses. Ostensibly, her visit was to attend and celebrate Senator Tom Harkin's final steak fry event, and it was to urge her fellow Democrats to make sure they come out and vote in November. But nobody could mistake the symbolism of Hillary Clinton in Iowa. Certainly not Steve Shepard. He's campaigns and elections editor for Politico and former editor-in-chief of The Hotline. Steve, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, Ken. My pleasure.
Well, we shouldn't say this was just a Clinton event because it was a Clinton's event because Bill was there too. But were you as shocked as the rest of us when you heard Hillary Clinton say she's thinking about running?
You know, I wasn't a shock. She obviously, nobody goes to Iowa by accident, and she had to acknowledge that possibility was at least out there. But look, you know how these schedules work. Nobody really gets in until after the midterm elections and probably until after the first of the year. So to say now with, 100-something days to go until that calendar comes up, yeah, she's thinking about it. And she's doing everything since the book tour that really a prospective candidate might do.
But Hillary Clinton is not just a regular prospective candidate. She's, let's face it, she's Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, the point is she's been doing whatever she has to do, and her Ready for Hillary people have been doing what they have to do in preparation for this time, 2016. So, I mean, she's not like any other kind of candidate who has to test the waters for Iowa.
No, that's absolutely right. And look, she freezes the Democratic field as long as she's considering jumping in. And Ready for Hillary is doing, you mentioned them, they're doing a lot of the legwork that could set up, and it'll be interesting to see what happens if she does get in, that could set up sort of a campaign infrastructure in waiting. Or it could just dissolve and be absorbed by whatever structure she sets up. That's going to be one thing to watch as we get into January and February and March if a potential Clinton campaign really takes place.
She's got a pretty complicated relationship with Iowa. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Obviously, you mentioned 2008, the last time she was in Iowa. Things did not go so well for her. A lot of people thought that maybe she should have skipped the Iowa caucuses in 2008, not really campaigned there. It wasn't necessarily as favorable for her as it was for Barack Obama and John Edwards. She finished behind those two candidates in Iowa, was able to go to New Hampshire and reverse that momentum and really reset the race going into South Carolina. But this time, there is no Barack Obama. There is really no John Edwards out there in the Democratic field right now. So it's a lot safer terrain for her than it was 8 years ago.
Well, let's stick with 8 years ago for this moment. Here she is on caucus night 2008. She sounded like she couldn't get out of Dodge too soon.
Thank you. Well, we're going to take this enthusiasm and go right to New Hampshire tonight. And I am as ready as I can be after having had this incredible experience here in Iowa.
Given the dynamic that we saw in 2008, so many people were so excited about Barack Obama. She made it clear that she thought that Iowa was overrated and not that important. What do you think the dynamics changed for Hillary Clinton in Iowa in the past 7 years?
Well, a lot of Democrats are, they're excited about her as a standard bearer nationwide, and I think that applies in Iowa too. Barack Obama managed to really dive into Iowa in 2007 since got into the race in neighboring Illinois in early 07, really made a big effort in Iowa, had a big grassroots movement in Iowa. In this case, there is no sort of other, we're only about 4 months away from when last cycle Barack Obama entered the race. So really things should be ramping up very, very soon, and you don't see that candidate on the horizon that could potentially challenge her there. So yes, Iowa is a bit of a field of screams, if you will, to torture the metaphor for Hillary Clinton in the past. But really right now, I think with the reception she got at the Harkin Steak Fry on Sunday really shows that she's sort of Democrats' number one, number two, number three choices at this point.
I know we still have over a year to go, and I know that there are Ready for Hillary groups sprouting up around the country. But is she organizing in Iowa, or is she reaching out to activists, and does she have to?
I think she has to. It's difficult to say. They call it the invisible primary for a reason, and it's difficult to say just how extensive that outreach gets while she's not an official candidate. That said, I think she's likely to learn from her mistakes 8 years ago in that primary. She's likely to go into Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina with her ducks in a row. There isn't that other candidate or other two candidates with the kind of national profile just yet who could peel away some of those influential, whether they happen to be power brokers in the states, in the early states, state legislators, county party chairs, state party chairs, influential donors, the kinds of people that you need to get on your side at this point in the campaign, in the first half of in this case, 2015, those folks don't necessarily have someone to whom they can gravitate. You know, Martin O'Malley's been to Iowa and New Hampshire a couple of times. Amy Klobuchar is going to Iowa again to do the Jefferson Jackson dinner later this month. But by and large, there
wait,
are...
Wait. What about that guy? What's his name? The guy who was vice president?
Joe Biden. Well,
right,
you know,
right.
It's funny you mention that. He's in Iowa on Wednesday giving a speech. It's an official event. But there he was in Iowa. And the symbolism is difficult to dismiss.
Given the fact that you saw all the pictures of her with Bill Clinton and Tom Harkin on Sunday, did she accomplish what she needed to do, whatever that was?
Well, you know, it's really tough to say. It's tough to see her next to Bill when it comes to these sort of events where it's part on the stump and then it's part sort of meeting and greeting with the sort of activist types that are going to be influential in these caucus meetings. And, you know, Bill is the master at that. For Hillary, it has never been second nature in the same way. That said, I think by and large she got the positive headlines she needed. She got the exposure in Iowa, and you know, now the next time she goes to Iowa, which might be potentially for Bruce Braley in his Senate race coming up in November, or it might be when she's an official candidate, at least she can say that she's been to Iowa since 2008, and she won't have that sort of bad taste in her mouth.
Steve Shepard is a campaigns and elections editor for Politico, and he's former editor-in-chief of National Journalist Hotline. You can find him on Twitter at Politico_Steve. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ken. It was my pleasure.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. You can find the Political Junkie on Facebook. We're the one with the button. And we're on Twitter at Ken Rudin and Ken Rudin Junkie. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington, still looking for my voice. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Don't stop.